From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present a preview of an upcoming episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast, in which Hank invited John Stone Street, president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview and co-host of Breakpoint, to discuss his new book, A Practical Guide to Culture, Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World. And now, here's Hank Hanegraaff.
And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the podcast that brings you some of the most interesting people on the planet. The conversation today is no exception, is John Stone Street. John is the president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview and co-host of Breakpoint, the daily cultural commentary founded by the late Chuck Colson. Yeah, and John has done a lot of work in a lot of different areas, including writing a book, along with his co-author, Brent Kundel, A Practical Guide to Culture, which we're going to be offering throughout the year through the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. John, it's good to have you with us.
Well, thanks, and thanks for calling me one of the most interesting people in the world. I mean, Hank, I've been called a lot of things, but man, I'm gonna put that on my bio sheet now. Hank Hanegraaff called me one of the most interesting people in the world. You can't take it back. It's too late. Sorry, yep.
Well, you know what? I called Rod Dreher the most interesting man in the world. I got that from, I think I got it from a beer commercial.
But, that's right, the Dos Equis man. Yeah, I think if there is a figure out there that's kind of like the Christian Dos Equis man, it's got to be Rod. I think you're right on that one.
Yeah, he's cool. I enjoyed doing Hank Unplugged with him, and I know I'm going to enjoy this conversation with you as well. Let's talk about Chuck Colson. I love Chuck Colson. I think he was one of the great Christian statesmen of this or any other time.
Well, listen, obviously I'm biased. I got to know Chuck over the last several years of his life. I mean, back in about 2007, and when I was working with Summit Ministries, and, you know, I ended up teaching as part of a program he had started called the Centurions Program, which was kind of a one-year deep dive into Christian worldview, kind of a Come Study with Chuck program that we continue on now. We've renamed it after Chuck. It's now called the Colson Fellows. But anyway, that was the first time I met Chuck, and he was, you know, just a larger-than-life figure. He was stunning on a number of levels. I mean, I remember they asked me to come teach Intro to Worldview to the Centurions class, so I showed up, and I thought I'd meet Chuck that weekend in person, which was really exciting. I didn't think he would actually sit through my entire talk, which he did. He sat in the back in an Intro to Worldview talk for the Centurions the whole time. I mean, I was just hoping people could hear me with my knees knocking so loud, you know. I mean, what a force of nature. But that was him. He was a learner, and he was a doer. He was a thinker, a learner, and a doer. I mean, you could put all that together. It was just one of those rare combinations. He didn't think you knew something unless you did something about it, and he didn't think you should stop learning. And so he had a brilliant mind. I mean, you knew him, Hank. I mean, he was just really a force of nature. And I'll tell you what, prophetic in a lot of different ways. So many things he talked about, people said he was overreacting, have come true. And some of the things he put in place, I mean, even the work he did to kind of establish co-belligerence between Catholics and evangelicals and different in the Manhattan Declaration with Orthodox Catholics and evangelicals, I mean, this is stuff that's just now we're seeing the value of it and so many of the issues that we face in terms of marriage, religious freedom, and life, and so on. So just really a force of nature.
I still remember when I was living back in California, I have 12 kids, so I don't answer the phone very often, and the phone kept ringing and ringing and ringing on a Saturday morning, and I finally picked it up, and it was Chuck Colson. He wanted to talk to me about Catholics and evangelicals together. He was in a pickle, and you know, everything was blowing up around him, and so he wanted to have a conversation, kind of bounce things off of me, and so we had this conversation, and it was a one-sided conversation. So he'd ask me a question, and then he'd answer the question. Then he'd ask me another question. He'd answer the question. He'd ask me another question. He'd answer the question. Then he started thanking me profusely for how much I'd helped him.
That's hilarious. Yeah, I tell you, he was just that guy. And that, I think that is one of the things that he weathered, the controversy around Catholics and evangelicals together. And now we look at, I mean, would we have sort of the co-belligerence on life, marriage, and religious liberty? Had not some of that work been done And of course, the Catholics and evangelicals together continues, you know, no question. So, and then of course, Breakpoint. I mean, I remember as a senior in high school is when I first heard Breakpoint on the radio. My mom listened incessantly to Moody Radio, and so all I knew was when Chuck was off the radio, I needed to be headed to school or I was going to be late. But even then, he was just doing something different. I mean, it wasn't just the really good teaching and preaching that you might hear on Moody Radio. It was also this, you know, Christians have to make sense of culture. We have to make a difference in the world. We're not just here to buy time until we go to heaven when we die. We've actually got to influence the culture and champion human dignity and, you know, all this stuff. And he did it in a way that was even distinct from the religious right at the time. And, you know, just an amazing guy. We miss him a lot. And so what we're trying to do at the Colson Center and what Eric and I try to do with Breakpoint is just carry that on.
He mentored so many guys like yourself, like myself. I remember one conversation I had with Chuck, and I was really upset about a book that had come out by Bruce Wilkinson, who was a friend of mine. He wrote a book called The Prayer of Jabez, and it had become really popular, and I thought the book was just horrible. And so I was sort of venting with Chuck, and Chuck said, "Hank, I know exactly what you're going to do. You're going to write a polemic. Don't do it." He said, "People are interested in prayer right now. What you need to do is write a value added." And I ended up writing a book called The Prayer of Jesus, which hit number one as a bestseller in nonfiction cloth-bound books. And it was a direct result of Chuck guiding me. And I think that had a profound impact on my life, because what Chuck told me in that conversation is, you are assuming that Bruce Wilkinson knows what you know, and perhaps he doesn't know what you know. You can't make that assumption. So write a value added. That was a seminal point in my life.
Well, and it's so wise, isn't it? I mean, Chuck championed the cultural mandate, and that's an example of it. I mean, so much of what passes for cultural engagement these days is just critique, right? I mean, here's everything that's wrong with the world, and here's everything. I mean, so much of that passes for worldview among Christians is critiquing other people for not lining up. And listen, there's plenty of things. I'm a huge fan of the Babylon Bee for that reason, you know, of the ability to kind of poke fun at ourselves as evangelicals or Christians. But at the end of the day, Christians are called not just to critique culture, but to create it and to make things and to contribute. And I think Chuck always kept that in mind. I mean, he was as fierce as anybody else, you know, in calling out error when he saw it. But he did not overestimate the theological depth of the church right now. He did not, but he thought it was the most important thing. And that's actually, Hank, one of the things that drew me to him as well is, you know, you kind of around worldview and apologetic circles, and it's, you know, so much of it is aimed at the culture, kind of yelling at the world for being lost, as opposed to really saying, hey, the church, we got to get ourselves straight. We got to get ourselves in line. And I thought Chuck did that as well as anybody. And that was a really powerful contribution he made to American Christianity, I think.
Let's talk about that for a moment, because I think you're spot on in underscoring that reality. I mean, so often what we do is we look at the culture, we talk about what's happening in the culture, and we're surprised. But we ought not to be surprised, because pagans are going to exercise their job description. What else would they do? The real problem is that Christians are not doing what Christians ought to be doing. And as a result of that, there's no leaven in the culture.
Well, that's right. If the salt loses its saltiness, you know, that sort of thing. The model of popular Christianity of either kind of being market-driven or come look at what all the cool things we're doing in the church, you know, has really kind of fostered this secular-sacred dichotomy, that sacred's what happens on Sunday and secular's where you go on Monday. And the motto, of course, of, you know, scripturally, is that you come to the church to equip the saints, so that the saints go and do the work of the ministry. Ministry doesn't happen in the church. Equipping does. And that means that there's not a division Sunday to Monday between what's sacred activity and what's secular activity. All of life is sacred. And so that's what happens. You know, I think when the church stops doing that, then we have to be able to identify where the culture's headed and why the culture's headed that way. And as the Christians, how we can speak to it. And I think that's one of the most important things that the church can do is recapture that sense of vocation and calling, you know, that all Christians are on mission. All Christians, whatever they do, it's not just to make money to give to the church or give to missions, but it is being fully human again. I think that's one of the things that I love so much. And Chuck sent me on a journey with a lot of different authors who talked about Christianity, not as being saved from our humanness, but being saved to a restored humanness. and that included the cultural mandate, our work in the world done before God for His glory that pointed ultimately to the restoration that Christ is bringing about of all things, and so on. I mean, this is kind of theological language that we don't often hear. So, you know, a guy like Rod Dreher, brings up that moralistic, therapeutic deism point from Christian Smith, and he's hitting that hammer again, and good for him, because if Christians only hear Christianity in a moralistic or a therapeutic way, we shouldn't be surprised when they become moralistic, therapeutic deist, right? If that's the sermon and the application of the scripture that they're hearing, making that extra jump to living our lives as part of the kingdom of God and seeing creation as part of the redemption narrative, you know, all of that sort of stuff that's embedded in scripture and was certainly the way Chuck Colson thought. Where are people going to get that sort of stuff? And I think that's what we're missing. And so then we turn around and we have, you know, the absolute, you get it in Romans 1, the absolute denial not only of God, but the denial of God leads to the denial of reality itself. You know, I read an article yesterday in the Huffington Post, you know, that men menstruate too. I mean, how do you get to that point as a culture? That's an absolute denial of reality, but that's what happens when the culture loses that church influence.
And the church has lost its influence in the culture. The culture, as a result of it, is heading south in a dramatic way. But it seems to me that there can be a new conversation starter. What I think about is, on the one hand, you have environmental ecology. On the other, you have ethical ecology. In other words, the left is obsessed with the pollution of the environment. The right is obsessed with the pollution of the moral environment. One obsessed with the natural environment, the other obsessed with the moral environment. They both have half the truth, and you can combine those as a whole. We ought to be obsessed about both.
Yeah, we absolutely, ought to be. But that requires kind of a return to an earthy Christianity. I just spent, Hank, the last couple months diving back into Kuiper. Of course, Abraham Kuiper was a hero of Chuck Colson's. And, for Kuiper, the most important thing that kind of drove his theology, and he was, interestingly enough, I just kind of went through his studies right when liberal theology got to the Netherlands. It wasn't as early as what happened in Germany. And so on. So, you know, he was tempted by liberalism. He has an authentic conversion experience. But for him, it was the connection, just what you said, between nature and grace, or how I would put it, between creation and redemption, that what God is doing in Christ is not something wholly new. It's something renewing. It's the same purposes that God had in creation that God has in Christ in redemption. And, that connection brings together both in the moral concerns that we have and our work in the world. I mean, our duty to make a difference in the world and in all aspects. And the blessedness of work, right? The sacredness, the dignity that comes from working. So you're right. I mean, that's what connects. But the biblical story does connect that. If we don't kind of take the Bible apart piecemeal and try to break it apart for, I think as Philip Yancey once called it, moral McNuggets. You know, you got to see it as the grand narrative that it is.
That's absolutely true. You know, your book, A Practical Guide to Culture, which you wrote with Brett, Brett talks about, he's a surfer, and he was talking about the difference between when you're surfing, the waves and the rip currents. So yeah. On the one hand, you have waves which are very, very visible, maybe like terrorist attacks. I mean, you see them, they're visible, you know the carnage that comes out of them and so forth, but they're also rip currents. I think about migration without assimilation. It's like the python swallowing its prey with a long and slow digestion. So there's a difference between the wave and the rip current, and I think that's one of the values in the book, A Practical Guide to Culture, helping the next generation navigate today's world, making that distinction. I mean, the waves, they're quite obvious to us, but the rip currents, not so much.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we really wanted to cover both. I mean, we wrote this book for really anyone invested in the next generation, parents, grandparents, youth pastors, Christian school leaders. And that's really what we were aiming at is, you know, there's been a lot of fascinating stuff written about culture. I mean, you know, Andy Crouch and, you know, one thinks of Mako Fujimura's new book and, you know, of course, Chuck, and it's been kind of theoretical. We felt like a lot of good insights have been gleaned from that, but it needed to be taken practical. And then there needed to be kind of a guide, like a handbook to these issues. But we knew that it couldn't just be the obvious ones, right? I mean, certainly we cover those. We have, you know, 10 of the most prominent issues that the next generation faces, you know, the growing addiction. We talked about some of these things. Pornography, I mean, it's epidemic. How do you just kind of get ahead of that? And that's the wave, you know. If you walk in on your kid looking at porn, you know it, you feel it, and it hurts. But these undercurrents, we've all had that experience where we're at the beach and, you know, we look up for our towel and somehow we find ourselves, we've been playing in the water and we're 20, 30, 40 yards down the beach. And how did that happen? And there have been some massive undercurrents that have taken our culture in a new direction over the last couple decades. We identify four of them that I think are particularly impactful of the next generation, has changed the way not only that they behave, and this is the key, but it's changed the way they think about themselves and about the nature of reality itself.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with John Stonestreet as they discuss the waves and powerful undercurrents operating in our culture today. Receive the book, A Practical Guide to Culture, Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World, as our appreciation for your financial partnership when you call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. We'll be back shortly with more of this special edition of the Bible Answer Man. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Waves aren't subtle. When you get hit by one, you know it. But beneath the surface, there are powerful currents that are not as easily detectable. Sometimes we're completely unaware of them until it's too late. The authors of A Practical Guide to Culture understand the cultural waves and currents of today. Waves are obvious issues pounding away at the Christian worldview, such as gender fluidity, casual sex, and pornography. Subtle undercurrents are issues such as the information age, identity, and perpetual adolescence. Being aware of these issues and how to address them is vitally important. Receive your copy of A Practical Guide to Culture as our appreciation for your financial partnership. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Are you the product of millions of years of unguided, purposeless, natural processes? Or are you created in the image of a loving God? Faced with the overwhelming scorn of evolutionary proselytizers, it can be hard to articulate the truth about God's creative work. And even among faithful Christians, many misconceptions linger. The Creation Answer Book by Hank Hanegraaff puts answers to the most hotly debated origins questions right at your fingertips, giving you clarity and understanding.
Learn to articulate the truth about our origins clearly and compassionately when you request your copy of the Creation Answer Book or listen to Hank's insightful answers with the unabridged audiobook version on CD. Receive your copy of the Creation Answer Book or the audiobook on CD from the Christian Research Institute when you call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. On this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff, we're bringing to you a preview of an upcoming episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast, in which Hank invited author John Stonestreet to discuss his book, A Practical Guide to Culture, Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World. Let's rejoin Hank and John as they discuss the waves and powerful undercurrents operating in our culture today.
There have been some massive undercurrents that have taken our culture in a new direction over the last couple decades. We identify four of them that I think are particularly impactful of the next generation, has changed the way not only that they behave, and this is the key, but it's changed the way they think about themselves and about the nature of reality itself. I mean, that's the big undercurrent. When it changes not only how you behave, but it changes the sort of world you think you live in and the sort of person you think you are, those are massive things. And so we wanted to help kind of unlock some of those things in a very practical way that parents could get out ahead of if they have young children and then directly confront if they're dealing with, you know, teenagers and young adults.
I want to talk about some of those things with you because you've identified this rip current. One of the issues is technology.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I have learned a ton from an MIT psychologist. I don't know if you've ever read Sherry Turkle, but I tried to bring Sherry Turkle to bear on this as well as my friend Kathy Cook. But Sherry's been writing on technology for 30 years. I mean, she was writing on technology back when they were trying to figure out, and this is in her words, how to keep computers busy. And that's such a funny line because today computers keep us busy, right? I mean, they're the ones that kind of demand our attention. But it's interesting. I read her in seminary, and the first two books that she wrote made some astounding predictions that came true. The first one was that computers wouldn't just be calculators. They would be places where we would actually live. And she said this before Al Gore invented the internet. I mean, so she was prophetic, you know, in this.
Exactly.
Her second book was in the 90s before social media. I mean, this is before Facebook and Twitter. There were chat rooms. But she said then that the computer was going to be a place where we would explore multiple identities, where, you know, 56-year-old men could be 20-year-old women. And it was great. She was a postmodernist in her view of identity. So she thought it was fantastic. Well, I didn't come across her third book until 2011. The book was called Alone Together. The first thing I noticed is that all the excitement and optimism about the way that technology would help us was gone. It was replaced with deep concern. And so I interviewed her on my radio program. I was like, well, you know, what changed? And she said, well, you know, I just wasn't prescient. I said, yeah, but what changed? And she said, well, a lot of things, but one of them is I have a teenage daughter. But what technology does is it lies to us about the world. It lies to us and makes us think that the world is a place that we make completely. And of course, there's some truth to our ability to make culture and to make the world, and this is the way God created us. But to give us that illusion of autonomy, and in particular, to get in the way of true relationships, that has really changed the way we're human with each other. And if the greatest commandment is to love God and to love our neighbor, if we think we live in a different sort of world when it comes to relationships than we do, then that's going to have a high impact on our ability to love well, to think well, to relate well. I mean, you even think about some just crazy examples of this, Hank. 25% of young people in Japan, according to a couple different surveys, this is 18 to 28, have no interest in sex. And you think, what? I mean, what is that? I mean, you know, we would think they would have too much interest in sex, but this is sex with an actual person. Because they can get pleasure anytime they want without putting out any effort through pornography, it's too much trouble to actually relate to another person. And the consequences of that go into birth rates and all kinds of things. I mean, this is the sort of consequences of technology that we don't realize. It changes the way we see other people, and that's a big deal.
I don't want to leave that subject because, again, the waves are the obvious things. The rip currents are not so obvious. maybe not obvious at all. Just as you said, you get swept away. You can't find your blanket anymore because now you're in trouble. You're in the midst of a rip current. But you talk about the information age. You talk about human identity after Christianity, as well as technology and perpetual adolescence. Cash that out a little bit more.
Yeah, the perpetual adolescence piece is fascinating. It's interesting, too. Ben Sass has been writing about this. His new book is about this. He had a piece in the Wall Street Journal that came out about the same time as our book did, and we had the same title. And that chapter of that book, if his article in the Wall Street Journal was Perpetual Adolescence, and ours in our book is Perpetual Adolescence and Castrated Geldings, which, of course, C.S. Lewis readers will recognize from The Abolition of Man. But we live in a radically different culture in which growing up and growing old and growing wise is no longer the goal. Now it's to stay young forever, where, in most cultures throughout the history of the world, kids went from being kids to being adults through a rite of passage, and there was a level of increased responsibility. In our culture, they become adolescents before they become adults. And adolescence is supposed to be 13 to 18, but everyone is recognizing now that adolescence is starting earlier and earlier and lasting longer and longer. In fact, many researchers will put it now as the age of life between 11 and 30. And, you call that failure to launch, essentially. I mean, you've got the average marrying age, starting your own kind of household. You know, that has gone up by about a decade. You have the high levels of debt, which reveal kind of this need of immediate gratification versus long-term thinking, which is a trait of adolescence. You have the effect that more 30-year-olds play video games, 30-year-old guys play video games than 18-year-old guys, right? So you can see it in the movies. You know, when I was in high school in the golden age of cinema, the 80s, all the knuckleheads in the movies were high schoolers. And then all the knuckleheads in the movies, that was like the days of Ferris Bueller and Marty McFly. And then it's in the 90s, it was Adam Sandler and Chris Farley, and they were in college or they were young. And now it's the married guys, right? And the Hangover and movies and that whole genre where you have these old married guys that want to be knuckleheads forever. And this is that's a big deal. To live in a culture where growing up is not the goal. And now, here's what relates to identity, Hank, is that God created us to be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it. That's our human purpose that's been corrupted by sin and part of that which is restored in Jesus Christ. If we don't know why we're here, if we're living for the moment instead of the future, it's not just a maturity issue, it's an identity issue. We don't know what God's created us for. And this is particularly hard in a culture on young women, because men then become the ones who kind of drive the whole, dynamics of the economy of dating and sexuality, and women have to play along. And, there's a lot of consequences that go through this. But here's the good news. I've been kind of, harping on all the bad things that are happening in culture. Here's the good news, Hank. If Christian kids are mature, if we can teach them about responsibility and leadership and that it's actually part of what God wants for them, it's like in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, right? So we can actually create the next generation of leaders in an age of adolescence. I think there's great potential here.
Well, we think about the forces that are shaping culture, and maybe talk about politics a little bit here. The ballot box is necessary, but it's not sufficient. A lot of Christians seem to think if we have a conservative or a quasi-conservative or a pseudo-conservative in the White House, all our problems are going to be solved. Whereas the culture is shaped by other forces. It's being shaped by education. It is being shaped by environmentalism. It's being shaped by the entertainment industry. I think during the Reagan Revolution, we had a conservative force from a government perspective, but yet the culture kept going into a nosedive direction. So I think that's something that needs to be cashed out as well. I mean, the forces that are shaping our culture are forces that oftentimes we imbibe in as Christians at the same level that the culture does.
Oh, listen, absolutely. I mean, you win by the sword, you lose by the sword. You win by politics, you lose by politics. Politics is a very fickle game. Chuck Colson used to say, it's one of my favorite lines of his, you know, that salvation will never come in Air Force One. And I sometimes fear that that's, again, it's like this perpetual temptation that we have to think that. And it's happening all over again. And we're seeing that, you know, if we don't rebuild culture, we tell the story in the book of an incident on Larry King Live back in the 90s. You know, this was at the time, maybe early 2000s. This was at the time when states were passing legislation to define marriages between a man and a woman. So these were marriage amendments at the state level, which of course were, you know, overturned. And I think they had their place, by the way, Hank. Let me just say, I mean, I think it was an important step. But, you know, the 21st straight state had put it to the voters, and the 21st straight state, I think it ended up being about 30 states that did this, but 21st straight state had voted and said, yes, we affirm marriage between a man and a woman. And Larry King had a gay activist on his show, and he said, you know, are you discouraged by this? And he said, not at all, because Will and Grace is the number one show on television. You know, Todd Gitlin in his book on the 60s said something similar. He said, after the 60s, the right marched on the White House and the left marched on the English departments. And, you know, you carry it out, you know, 10 years later, they both got what they had marched on, or 15, 20 years later, they both got what they had marched on. And ultimately, you know, the left, you know, has, even though they don't have the White House right now, they, you know, the power of the administrative state and the political levels of administration and so on. I mean, it's just stunning. Culture is almost always upstream from politics, particularly the cultural imagination, those things which shape the narrative of the culture, education and the arts, and entrepreneurship, you know, the sort of world we want to create, the creative gifts of humans. It's exactly what God gave them to us. It's one of our most powerful assets, and it's also one of the most powerful problems that we can have. So you're absolutely right on that.
You know, you mentioned Larry King Live, and sometimes in a nostalgic way, I think back to Larry King Live. I mean,
yeah, we miss him now, don't we?
Yeah, I mean,
it's gotten a lot worse since then.
Yeah, I remember doing the program, and you have a full hour to discuss a particular subject, and it gives people to a chance to think about it. Whereas now it's Anderson Cooper, and you've got get a panel of 10, 15 people. I don't know what the number is, but a lot of people. They're all sound bites. They're all talking points, and at the end of the day, you get nothing out of it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's one of the challenges that we talk about in the chapter on information, is that in our culture, information has replaced knowledge. It's interesting. You go back to just a remarkable work by T.S. Eliot called Choruses from the Rock. And it was kind of, I don't even know really what it was. It was kind of like a play sort of thing that he wrote. But anyway, he says in it, he's got this wonderful line. He's like, where is all the knowledge? Where's all the learning we have lost in knowledge? Where's all the wisdom we have lost in learning? Where's all the learning we lost in knowledge? Where's all the knowledge we lost in information? We live in a day and age where people will encounter more information on a daily basis than any other generation that's ever lived. And so ideas come at us uncontextualized. Assertions get confused for arguments. You know, we always talk about, in Christian education circles, we teach kids how to think, not what to think. That's got to stop being a mantra. That's got to start being reality. I mean, that's got to start actually shaping what we mean. If kids don't have discernment as an antidote or as an inoculation against this information, we're just two sides yelling at each other. Deception is going to come really easy. I mean, you know, you see this as well. I see this with, with teenagers that I speak to or with, is that most of the time when it comes to some of these big moral issues, they're not concerned about being right or wrong. They're concerned about being mean or nice.
We'll pick up Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with John Stonestreet in just a few moments. Waves aren't subtle. When you hit one, you know it. But beneath the surface, there are powerful currents that are not as easily detectable. Sometimes we're completely unaware of them until it's too late. John Stonestreet and his co-author Brett Kunkel understand the cultural waves and currents of today. As they explain in their book, A Practical Guide to Culture, waves are obvious issues pounding away at the Christian worldview, such as gender fluidity, casual sex, consumerism, and pornography. Subtle undercurrents are issues such as the information age, identity, technology, and perpetual adolescence. Being aware of these issues and how to address them is vitally important. Receive A Practical Guide to Culture, helping the new generation navigate today's world. As our appreciation for your financial partnership, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. We'll be back after the break with more of the Hank Unplugged podcast interview with John Stonestreet on this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Are you the product of millions of years of unguided, purposeless, natural processes? Or are you created in the image of a loving God? Faced with the overwhelming scorn of evolutionary proselytizers, it can be hard to articulate the truth about God's creative work. And even among faithful Christians, many misconceptions linger. The Creation Answer Book by Hank Hanegraaff puts answers to the most hotly debated origins questions right at your fingertips, giving you clarity and understanding. Learn to articulate the truth about our origins clearly and compassionately when you request your copy of the Creation Answer Book, or listen to Hank's insightful answers with the unabridged audiobook version on CD. Receive your copy of the Creation Answer Book or the audiobook on CD from the Christian Research Institute when you call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. Waves aren't subtle. When you get hit by one, you know it. But beneath the surface, there are powerful currents that are not as easily detectable. Sometimes we're completely unaware of them until it's too late. The authors of A Practical Guide to Culture understand the cultural waves and currents of today. Waves are obvious issues pounding away at the Christian worldview, such as gender fluidity, casual sex, and pornography. Subtle undercurrents are issues such as the information age, identity, and perpetual adolescence. Being aware of these issues and how to address them is vitally important. Receive your copy of A Practical Guide to Culture as our appreciation for your financial partnership. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're bringing to you a preview of an upcoming episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast, in which Hank invited author John Stonestreet to discuss his book, A Practical Guide to Culture, Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World. Let's rejoin Hank and John as they grapple with the very meaning of culture.
The biggest word on the cover of your book is the word culture, and I fear that a lot of people really don't know what's meant by culture as opposed to, let's say, what's meant by worldview. Define the terms.
Yeah, that's a great point. We spend the whole first part of the book trying to do kind of culture, taking some of the wisdom from some of these great books on culture and distilling them down to, okay, here's what we mean. Here's what we're looking at. We talk about culture as just simply the world that people make of the world. You know, this is a good thing. A lot of times culture is used in Christian circles as kind of a synonym for all the bad stuff in the world. But really what culture is what God intended humans to do, which is to make something of the world. The issue isn't that we have culture. The issue is which direction that culture takes and what are the ideas and the vision of life in the world that's embedded in the culture. And culture's power is in what it perceives to be normal. I mean, we've all had this experience where we might leave this country and go to another culture, or maybe leave LA and go to, you know, southern Mississippi. And you can immediately see that they've made different worlds in those two places. That's where it strikes us. But when you're in it, it just seems so normal. And that's what we're dealing with when we're talking about teenagers. You know, as parents, I mean, even my generation, I'm not that old, I'm 41 years old, but you talk about those in the 60s or 70s, they've seen the shifts in culture and they have felt those transitions take place. But you got to realize, I mean, the average 15, 16 year olds, they don't remember, you know, America before Obama. Right? They don't even remember, you know, Obama evolving on same-sex marriage. So for them, it's just what's so normal. And so the power of having a Christian worldview, which is basically the framework through which you see life in the world, is the ability to look at culture and discern it, to point out that what seems normal is actually not. And so being able to look at culture is being able to look at the ideas of culture, being able to look at the structures of culture, being able to see the assumptions of culture. C.S. Lewis once said that the most dangerous ideas are not the ones argued, but the ones assumed. And having a Christian worldview, a Christian framework, allows you to be able to do that. Now, most people get their frame of reference, their worldview, their vision of reality from the culture. So they just catch it like they caught a cold. They caught it from the world around them. What we want is to help kids develop a Christian worldview so that they can, with discernment and clarity, truth and love, look at culture and the people in culture with the heart and mind of Christ.
So the difference between a genuine Christian worldview and what is mistaken for a genuine Christian worldview, where someone becomes a baptized secular humanist. They take on all the trappings of Christianity, but they're still immersed in a cultural worldview. I want you to talk about that a little bit, because one of my great fears is that the Christian faith has become purely transactional. So what happens is someone prays a prayer, they get the card that gets them out of hell and gets them into heaven, and they never experience what it means to be transformed by the grace of God, experiencing the graces of God which transform us. This is, to me, the systemic problem within the church. We're transactional as opposed to recognize that we can be transformed within the ground and pillar of truth, the church, by the graces that God dispenses. We can go into the spiritual gymnasium, as it were, and be transformed.
You've exactly nailed it. I remember in college, one of my friends using this language, you know, that many Christians are secularists with a twist. You know, I think you can see this when you look kind of close to the ground on an issue, for example, marriage. So we've spent the last 40 or 50 years talking about marriage in evangelical circles, but primarily about behavior. You know, here's how to have a godly marriage. Here's how to have a good sex life, or, you know, good finances and so on, which is great. But the whole time, the definition of marriage, our fundamental understanding of what marriage is for, was stolen away by the culture. T.S. Eliot also said, before you decide what to do with something, you need to decide what that something is for. And that's almost the entire ballgame right there. And that's the sort of transformation that you're talking about. It's not just decorating our lives with Christian morality, even if we get that far. A lot of times, like you said, it's just decorating our lives with that kind of Christian eternity, you know, being able to go to heaven when we die. My friend Matt Hurd, you know, talks about how, you know, this is the part A and the part B of the gospel, John 20, you know, all these things were written so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ. And that's part A, is getting those facts right so that you believe the right things and so on. But part B is that by believing, you might have life in his name. And of course, that John's understanding of life wasn't life after death. It was quality of life. It was the essence of life. It was the life that only comes from the author of life. That word Zoe, my daughter's middle name is Zoe for that reason. It's this brand new way of living, this renewed way of living that's transformational. And God's given us the resources of the scripture, which no matter what the culture says, you know, reality is the Bible gives us the bigger than culture story, right? The story of creation to new creation.
Yeah, we sort of lost the sense of all of that. I mean, it's not as though it's not prevalent in the literature. You go Mere Christianity, just reading that again, and Lewis talks about the tin man becoming a real man, and that not just through biological energy, but through Zoe.
Oh, exactly. And you see, there are a lot of people that have tried to kind of write about this, but you talked about it earlier, and it's the trappings of culture. You know, it's the fact that a lot of times when we go to church, what's happening there is entertainment. It's not participation or involvement, right? We're sitting down, we're looking forward. Somebody's kind of putting on a program for us. We're maybe being emotionally moved like we would at a play or something like that. And then we go back into our lives. And so there's that Sunday versus Monday dichotomy. There's the participation versus, you know, being an audience. And these things are not small things. I'm really thankful, honestly, for a lot of this renewed emphasis on issues of formation. I mean, Rod Dreher and I have had this conversation a lot. I think St. Augustine talked a ton about that we become what we love. And so cultivating our hearts and our souls to love the right things. My mentor, Bill Brown, who now works for us at the Colson Center and in charge of the Colson Fellows Program, he says, you know, the greatest commandment isn't to believe. It's to love. And love is a participatory sort of thing. Love God, love your neighbor. And as Augustine said, we become what we love. We're love-shaped people, or what we worship. This is the sort of formation I think that's been a helpful, I would say maybe even a corrective to the way we've done worldview in the past. But I look at Chuck's life, and he's an example of this, right? I mean, this rough and tumble, unbelievably gifted, talented guy, so good that he was in the White House at 36, you know, suddenly God turns him around, and he's still a rough and tumble, gifted guy who can get things done like nobody else, but he was forgiven, and that made him a different sort of person. And that's the sort of transformation I think you're talking about.
Yeah, I am, and maybe even to expand on this a little bit. I mean, I walk into church now with a completely different concept. When I open the doors of the cathedral, my mind switches over to the notion that I'm here to worship God. This is not about entertainment. It's not even about getting a good sermon. I might get a good homily or sermon, but it's not about that. It's about worshiping God. And I think that we need to communicate the message that we are created in the Imago Dei, in the image and likeness of God, and we are fulfilled when we worship God. And if we worship God rightly, we can love other people rightly. So this whole idea of Christ being a means to our ends, this consumeristic idea of Christianity, has to give way to a notion that ultimately transforms and fills the God-shaped vacuum that Pascal talked about.
Absolutely, because we will fill ourselves with something or other. In the chapter, you talked earlier about this, but one of the undercurrents that we talk about in the book is the chapter on identity. And, you know, we become what we worship, Psalm 135 says. And, you know, you look back and you say, well, what do we worship? And one of the things we worship is stuff. So what our culture, you know, sells us is that we are stuff-shaped people. We have a stuff-shaped hole in our heart that can only be filled by a Lexus, right? And so that actually becomes, it shapes our soul and our identity. But God's created us so that the only thing big enough to fill that hole ultimately is himself. I mean, we dealt in the book about addiction and suicide both. And even since then, the reports have come out in terms of the opioid addiction around America. There was a stunning article in First Things this past month. I don't know if you saw it, about suicide. And it's not an accident that as a culture moves away from God and seeks to fill a hole big enough that only God can fill it with other things, that eventually that pursuit of meaning is you're going to run out of gas. And we see that right now with young adults, and many of us fear this as parents. With young adults, the second killer of young adults is suicide. I mean, that's crazy. That's crazy. You know, we have more stuff than ever before. I remember seeing Louis C.K., the comedian, on Conan O'Brien. It's like, you know, we have more stuff than ever before. And he said it's wasted on the worst generation ever. I'm not going to say it like that. I'm going to say we do. We have more toys and more stuff, but it's not satisfying. Why is that the case? And it's really, we got to get back to what God created us to do, to worship Him. And our hearts are restless, Augustine said, until they find rest.
One of the great points you make in A Practical Guide to Culture, helping the next generation navigate today's world, is that one of the biggest, if not the biggest, cultural lie is that our identity can be found in something other than the Imago Dei. To put it in other terms, our culture has lost what it means to be human. And you have this situation right now where kids at very early ages are determining that their biology their gender is not determined by their biology. And so as a result of that, they're taking hormone treatments and they're being devastated by a cultural narrative. The cultural narrative is telling them something that is so false and so damaging. I don't know how to put it other than we're soaring to the wind, we're reaping the whirlwind.
Yeah, and it's child abuse. Look, I mean, it's one thing, when you see somebody who ought to know better. But you're talking about a generation of kids who have been lied to from the very time that they're born. They've been told that truth is whatever they feel. They have been told that there's no such thing as ultimate right and wrong. They have told that every opinion counts on the mere condition that they have it. And they have been told from the very beginning that the most significant thing about who they are, without any exception, are their sexual inclinations and self-identifications. And it's as if, I mean, you talk about a set of lies. I mean, it really is. It's child abuse. We often say around the Colson Center, you know, there's that famous line, ideas have consequences, from that old book. It's true, but the reason that matters is that ideas have consequences for people. So bad ideas have victims. I tell you what, the option of sending our kids without any assistance, without any guidance, without any anchors into this culture is setting them up to fail. They're simply, we simply have to be with them. We have to be with them. So hopefully this book can be a help. It can be a guide. It's very practical. There are some really specific suggestions as well as and strategies, as well as kind of the ideological framework of here's really where we've gotten to and why and so on. But man, we got to be in the game with them. We cannot expect them to survive this culture without help.
The book, A Practical Guide to Culture, Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World. John, it's been a blast talking to you.
Hey, it's always fun, Hank. We should do this more often. And I think I'm so thankful for your work and your ministry and your friendship with Chuck Colson and your ongoing support of what we're doing. And so thanks so much. It's always an honor to be with you.
You got it.
Well, we've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. To listen to this Hank Unplugged podcast interview with John Stonestreet in its entirety, it'll be available in the near future at equip.org, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Stand shoulder to shoulder with Hank Hanegraaff and the Christian Research Institute in the battle for life and truth, and receive as our thanks for your gift the book, A Practical Guide to Culture, Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World. Simply call our resource consultants now at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write to us at CRI, Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter. Are you the product of millions of years of unguided, purposeless natural processes? Or are you created in the image of a loving God? Faced with the overwhelming scorn of evolutionary proselytizers, it can be hard to articulate the truth about God's creative work. And even among faithful Christians, many misconceptions linger. The Creation Answer Book by Hank Hanegraaff puts answers to the most hotly debated origins questions right at your fingertips, giving you clarity and understanding. Learn to articulate the truth about our origins clearly and compassionately when you request your copy of the Creation Answer Book, or listen to Hank's insightful answers with the unabridged audiobook version on CD. Receive your copy of the Creation Answer Book or the audiobook on CD from the Christian Research Institute when you call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. Waves aren't subtle. When you get hit by one, you know it. But beneath the surface, there are powerful currents that are not as easily detectable. Sometimes we're completely unaware of them until it's too late. The authors of A Practical Guide to Culture understand the cultural waves and currents of today. Waves are obvious issues pounding away at the Christian worldview, such as gender fluidity, casual sex, and pornography. Subtle undercurrents are issues such as the information age, identity, and perpetual adolescence. Being aware of these issues and how to address them is vitally important. Receive your copy of A Practical Guide to Culture as our appreciation for your financial partnership. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org.